there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek there, but also I suppose part of my heart is also in the title, and I'll tell you about that. What I thought I would do is going to be a very informal presentation, but some of the material for it of a very general populist nature has just appeared in an article entitled Quantum Criticality and It's in Nature, January the 20th, which is last Thursday. And this article, which I wrote with Andy Schofield, who unfortunately isn't here this week but was here last week, talks about quantum criticality and quantum phase transitions. And this particular edition is Nature, part of Nature magazine's attempt to celebrate the Einstein centenary. And so we were given the onerous task of trying to link up quantum phase transitions and some of the work that's going on in condensed matter physics today with Einstein's miraculous year in 1905. And as we started to think about this, actually, we came across a very delightful story, which does in fact connect up the two worlds, and which I wanted to tell you now, and use that as a launching pad to discuss the problem of quantum phase transitions and the crisis that it puts our field in today. If you think back none of us can actually think back to 100 years ago because we weren't alive then, but our knowledge of the history of physics 100 years ago tells us that one of the great crises of physics was, of course, the Michelson-Morley experiment. But around the same time as this crisis was going on, a crisis in some ways just as profound, yet perhaps not quite as impressive, was going on and challenging the founders of 20th century physics. And this was the crisis of specific heat. And it connects up with a story I'm going to tell you about, because today, in the early part of the 21st century, we have a similar crisis in our understanding of the properties of matter. And the puzzle, as I said, was not something that stemmed from astrophysical observations, but from the observation that the amount of heat it took to warm up matter was actually much lower at low temperatures than was expected from the theory of the day. And if you may remember, back in the 19th century, there was a famous theory which we're taught, or principle of Dulong and Petit, which was that the specific heat capacity measured per mole, or per atom, if you believed in atoms, many people didn't at the time, was constant. And by the time of 1876, this had been raised to the highest form of theory of the time by Ludwig Boltzmann. And of course, he had shown that CV is equal to N times R. And this was a triumph of 19th century system mechanics, and was believed to be one of those principles. It was one of the solid things that they knew about the behavior of matter. Yet by the end of the 19th century, this tremendous triumph was looking increasingly hollow. One of the reasons was that people who believed in atoms and molecules couldn't quite see how to count the number of degrees of freedom. If you have a molecule twirling around, how many degrees of freedom does it have, and when are they activated? The other problem was that technology was catching up with the field, and the development of the cryostat meant it was now possible to cool matter down to what were at the time incredibly low temperatures. And this was done in diamond for the first time, and the curve of specific heat of diamond comes out looking something like this as you cool down. And at high temperatures does indeed seem to fit with the value predicted by Boltzmann, but at low temperatures it plummets away. And the reaction of the theorists of the time, the leaders of the field at the time, were actually rather telling and rather interesting, and actually recorded. And this is discussed at length in Price's book, Subtle as the Lord, if you want to read it in more detail. But in a nutshell, there were reactions of Boltzmann, Lord Kelvin, and Lord Rayleigh. And Boltzmann was worried about this, this clear discrepancy, and he suggested that perhaps the way atoms behave in a dense medium was more complicated than he assumed. He'd, of course, assumed a gas when he did this. Kelvin, on the other hand, looked to the mathematics of Boltzmann's derivation and felt the answer lay there. In other words, he thought maybe a mistake had been made. And it was only Rayleigh who had the confidence to stand up, to look at the experiment, endorse it as being sound, and to say that we thought the theory is correct, the experiment was correct, and that there was really a true crisis, which perhaps could only be resolved by fresh new insight. And this was around 1904. So we're now really at the anniversary of the solution of this problem. It took place at the end of 1905, and the paper was published in 1906. Of course, the solution came from Einstein, and what Einstein did was to actually, in some sense, turn to the stars for inspiration, the light of the stars. And of course, we all know that not long beforehand, Planck had derived his formula relating the color of stars to their temperature. And in 1905, Einstein interpreted this in terms of his quanta idea, the idea that photons are made up of packets of energy. And he then turned and said, well, what happens if matter itself is quantum, is quantized in the same way? So what he did, of course, was to suggest that rather than having propagating photons, one might have stationary vibrating modes, which we now know as the Einstein phonon. And of course, his famous relationship related the energy to the frequency of the mode and the Boltzmann factor. And this relationship, once differentiated with respect to temperature, actually falls pretty much on the dot, on the nail of this data. And Einstein was so proud of this fit that he actually published the data in his paper on the Einstein phonon, 1906. And what's remarkable about this paper is that it put in perspective, it confirmed long before the Rutherford atom or the Bohr atom, long before the advent of the Schrödinger equation, it was the first sense that matter was quantum mechanical. And furthermore, in some sense, he set in motion at this point the idea and the whole discipline of the quantum theory of solids. Notice that this was really, in some sense, the stat mech of the harmonic oscillator. And it wasn't until 1924 that Heisenberg solved the harmonic oscillator using his new quantum mechanics. By the time of 1930, physicists had learned about fermions, and the specific heat crisis was essentially solved by 1930. But it's an interesting story because we have a specific heat crisis upon us today. And the bad actors of the crisis that face us today are really materials at the forefront of material science. These are ultra-pure crystals, which have very exotic and very interesting properties. And I believe it's no exaggeration to say that the properties that we're seeing really do plunge our field into crisis. Now, to give you some background to this, of course, physics traditionally studies the stable phases of matter. And we know of many wonderful stable phases of matter, from ferromagnets, antiferromagnets, ferroelectrics, superconductors, and these are all examples of new phenomena that can come from the interaction of atoms and electrons inside matter. But the interest in quantum phase transitions really focuses on unstable quantum matter, and modern technology permits us to tune materials to the point of instability, the precarious point where order is about to appear. And the remarkable thing is that those special points, known as quantum critical points, seem to nucleate new kinds of properties within matter. And the crisis that we're discussing today concerns those new properties and our inability to describe them concisely in terms of a simple theory. So any questions before I go on? Okay, so of course...
Perhaps I could just ask you, it's a brief answer. How did Einstein get this equation sort of without understanding quantum statistics, Bose statistics?
He used the fluctuation dissipation theorem, basically, to write down the specific heat capacity. Mm-hmm. And he basically took what Planck had done and threw away the momentum. I mean, to be quite frank with you, he hypothesized that you could just have a very simple quantum of energy. In a way, it was the simplest thing you could do, but you're right. I mean, he did have Boltzmann's distribution function in mind here, and the idea that energy was quantized in that function there, in units of n times h bar omega. It was one of those things. I mean, of course, we don't really know the answer to that question. It was a blinding flash of brilliance, in all truth. Of course, when you talk about materials science to the person on the plane next to you, they think about plastics or flak jackets. This is in part one of the problems here is that when we talk about modern materials, people envision things of ever greater complexity. And because they're used to the computer solving everything, they imagine that, well, the key to understanding complex materials is to come up with a machine that can extract all of those complex details of the electron and the atomic motions. And of course, that's far from the truth. Even the most stalwart of the lattice cage theorists know that the ability of the computer to simulate the behavior of correlated matter is extremely limited. But fortunately, of course, there's collective behavior in matter. And that collective behavior leads to emergent properties, and we attempt to capture those properties in terms of simple principles and simple models. And of course, things such as superconductivity, ferromagnetism, ferroelectricity are testament to the emergence of simple principles and simple properties as a result of collective behavior. But what we're going to talk about today are transformations between ordered states, or between an ordered and a disordered state, and in particular the focus is on phase transitions. Before I talk about some of the detailed experiments, let me remind you about phase transitions. Of course, we know that phase transitions are ubiquitous, and they not only control the crystallization of water, but if this audience is to be believed, they govern the emergence of time itself, the properties of the early universe. And so the study of phase transitions is extremely important. And one of the things that was discovered in the 20th century is that phase transitions, particularly when they become second order, develop universal properties. And so if you look at the critical point of water, then the exponents that govern the growth of correlations and the power law properties of that critical point are the very same ones that govern the critical point of the Ising ferromagnet in three dimensions.
And I thought the water first order.
It is first order, but if you look at the end of the boundary, at the critical end point of the transformation, okay, right? At the critical point of steam and water, I should have really said steam and water, right? Okay. And of course, this underpins the fact that despite the fact that the short-range interactions of a magnet and a water are extremely different, nevertheless, the long-range properties become universal. And one of the reasons for this is that we know that close to a second-order phase transition, matter develops a kind of critical droplet, this region of space in which the order parameter develops power law correlation. Whereas outside, of course, it develops exponential correlations. And, of course, the study of classical critical phenomena is really the study of the behavior of matter inside this critical droplet, which develops close to a second-order phase transition. So, typically, the physics inside that droplet is entirely classical. And the reason it's classical is that as the correlation length grows, the characteristic energy scale associated with those low-energy modes that govern the critical behavior drops down and down and down. It doesn't take very long before its characteristic frequency, which might be, rho times q squared, becomes much, much less than kBT. It is then a classical phase transition. But what we're going to talk about today are quantum phase transitions. And at a quantum second-order phase transition, you have to be in a situation in which you can lower the temperature sufficiently low that all the characteristic modes inside the droplet are still quantum mechanical in character. And to do that, and this point was first realized by John Hertz, well, there were others around, but he was perhaps the one that we normally attribute it to, was that in order to get new quantum critical behavior, you'd have to be able to suppress the transition temperature of a phase transition to absolute zero. And he realized that if you could do that, then the macroscopic properties of the material might be transformed and quantum mechanics might govern the system mechanics in this critical region. So he put together a theory of this, the Hertz theory, which was relevant to ferromagnets. Now, it turns out that the type of the area in which quantum phase transitions have been most extensively studied concerns magnetic phase transitions. And one of the reasons for this is that in the case of magnetism, we have a lot of control and through the diversity of materials we can study, we can find systems in which the characteristic magnetic scale is very, very small and can then be tuned by adjusting some external parameter to zero. And that can be pressure, it can be chemical doping, it can be the application of an external magnetic field. And typically, you're dealing with a situation in which you have some classical phase transition line, TC, which is driven down to zero. And if you're lucky, that phase transition will remain second order all the way down, okay? If you're lucky. Now what's so very interesting is that we can then look at matter, which has been tuned to this critical point, and look at its properties as we come down towards this point here. And it wouldn't have come into the physicist's eye were it not for the fact that we have now a great many systems where we can tune the magnetic phase condition to zero, and we found that in a broad region of the finite temperature phase diagram, the electronic properties and the thermodynamic properties are very different to those we expect. And that's what I'm going to spend the last part of this talk discussing. Now, to do this, I need to remind you of a few things about matter. And in particular, since most of this work is carried out in the realm of metallic systems, let me remind you of a few key things about metallic systems. And of course, one of the key differences between one of the key properties of a metal is the fact that the waves that carry the charge, the electrons, are fermions. And if you want to use the analogy a little bit like apples in a barrel, you see. They can't all go into the same quantum state because of Pauli's exclusion principle. So just as when you fill atoms in a barrel, it's only the atoms on, they can't all go down to the bottom, so they gradually fill up to some level. And, of course, it's only the apple, if you fill up your thing with apples, it's only the apples at the top which are accessible for you to eat. And in a similar way, when we take when you take a metal and we try to excite it, unless we take a very high energy source, it's only the electrons within kBT of the Fermi energy that can be excited. And this leads to certain standard properties of a metal. It in fact means that their specific heat capacity is extremely low, low temperatures, and in particular the specific heat capacity is proportional to the density of states at the Fermi surface times the temperature. And experimentalists call the quantity CV over T, which is gamma. And in a traditional metal, gamma becomes constant at low temperatures. And that's what's called a Fermi liquid. So, a few years ago, in the mid-90s, a group at Karlsruhe decided that they could look at what happens to the specific heat capacity of a metal tuned to quantum criticality. And they took a metal which is called cerium copper 6. And this, to the outsider, is to a zeroth order of approximation, is copper. Okay? and putting in the cerium does not stop it from being a metal like copper, excepting the cerium actually contains magnetic moments. And these magnetic moments are on the edge of magnetic reordering. Accepting the zero-point motions of those magnetic moments prevent them from ordering, and it forms an extremely delicate metal. And in this metal, the gamma of cerium copper 6 gold is about 1,000 times that of copper, it turns out. Which means, translated into the inertial masses of the electrons at the Fermi surface, their effective masses are about 1,000 times that of a free electron. And that's already quite a remarkable property, some of which is due to the way the magnetic moments are melted and incorporate themselves into the Fermi liquid around them. So what they found in this material was that they could actually dope it with gold. And what the gold does is it expands the lattice. It provides a kind of negative pressure on the material. And this negative pressure brings actually the system to a point where you're essentially tuning it this way in this diagram. So you can tune it, and by the time you have a 10% gold, you sit at this point here. And one of the things they discovered when they did this was that the specific heat capacity was actually much larger than expected. And in particular, whereas in the gold-free sample, the heat capacity looks something like this, with CV over T, and this is quite often on a logarithmic temperature scale. By the time they got up to gold 0.1, the material had developed a heat capacity that looked like this. Okay? So that CV over T is actually logarithmically dependent, something like this. Okay. And one of the funny things they found was that they could put more gold in and take it to the point where it magnetically ordered. And then they could apply pressure and bring it back down, and once again it would sit on this line. So that then eliminated the worry that this phenomenon was dirt induced. The fact that you could put more gold in, bring it back, and it lay on the same line looks kind of universal. That's already very disturbing, that you've got all these additional quantum states at low temperatures. And many quantum critical systems show the same behavior. Some show even, only one, shows an even more dramatic upturn at the lower temperatures, with a T to the 1/3. That's disturbing feature number one. Okay? And the other feature that's very odd is that, for the same reason about the barrels of apples in the apples in the barrel, turns out that at low temperatures, Electrons can't scatter off one another very easily in a traditional metal. And one of the classic properties of this is that the resistivity due to inelastic scattering is proportional to the density of states squared now times the temperature squared. And this quadratic behavior of resistivity is a characteristic of strongly interacting electrons, where the scattering comes from electron-electron scattering. And in fact, the relationship between this quadratic coefficient here and the linear coefficient here is known as the Kadowaki-Woods relation, and it's followed over a wide range of metals over many decades of the value of gamma. But in these particular systems, it turns out that the specific heat capacity, the resistivity at low temperatures seems to go like constant, and in this particular case, plus A times T, or A times T to some power, which is much smaller than 2. And so this is then the demise of two stalwart features of the electron fluid. And when you get something like that happening, it means that you've really got a new kind of metal. And it raises the question, well, what are the quasi-particles? What are the excitations? What is the correct description of matter tuned to this quantum critical point? By the way, another reason for interest in this is that we have another example of an electron fluid that we don't understand well at all, and that is the metallic state of the cuprate superconductors. The cuprate superconductors go superconducting at 30, 40, maybe 100 Kelvin, and they have the property that in the normal state they have a linear resistance. The resistance is so linear it goes from the transition temperature all the way up to 1000 Kelvin, and to the naked eye it's beautifully linear. And nobody knows what the origin of this linear resistivity is. But one idea is it may have a common origin with these quantum critical points which develop this linear or quasi-linear resistivity at this point. Now, let me tell you one other aspect of these quantum critical points. And that is that it turns out that either side, we do see metallic behavior that we can understand. The T squared resistance can be seen here and here quite often. But as we squeeze them into this critical point, the region over which the T-squared behavior extends and the region over which the metallic behavior of the Fermi liquid variety can be seen squeezes down towards zero. And this is kind of weird for us in condensed matter physics. We normally think of the region over which metallic behavior extends as this kind of is the Fermi temperature, and that can be thousands of Kelvin. But in these systems, the characteristic temperature of the metal is being squeezed down so it's far below any characteristic chemical scale or atomic scale in the problem, which is then a situation where you might expect universality at high temperature, something we're not accustomed to in condensed matter physics. Normally, the high temperature world for us is the non-universal world, whereas perhaps in particle physics it's a universal world. So here, this exotic metallic fluid that develops around the quantum critical point is very interesting because it might actually embody some kind of universal physics. Okay, so these things were discovered, as I said, around 1996, and there's now a profusion of such anti-ferromagnetic quantum critical points. There are also a few ferromagnetic quantum critical points in which, unfortunately, although the magnetic state is simpler, the phase transition is terminated by a first-order phase transition. So what have theorists been doing to try to understand all of this, and what about Mr. Hertz's original theory? Okay. Mr. Hertz's original theory was really the natural extension of Landau-Ginzburg theory, or 5 to the 4 field theory, into the quantum mechanical domain. Now, of course, in the realm of relativistic field theory, that's a very simple thing to do. You just add time as another dimension. And what Hertz did was to realize that these kinds of phase transitions take place in the background of a Fermi surface. And that Fermi surface produces dissipation. It produces a decay of the collective modes. And what that means in a nutshell is that the Lagrangian that describes the quantum critical point, the Hertzian Lagrangian, basically involves an action in which the, if we look at the modes at momentum q, we have a mass, a q squared, but typically you have a dissipation term, which in a Euclidean language or Matsubara language has a term which looks like this. And then of course you have your cipher fourth term. And Hertz recognized that because of this, time would not count in the same way as space. For example, here you see q squared coming in with frequency to the linear power. And if there's no q dependence to this gamma here, which is the case for an anti-ferromagnet, that means that you must count every spatial dimension every time dimension as two spatial dimensions. Okay? And so Hertz then said that the effective dimension for an anti-ferromagnet, well, he looked at ferromagnets, would be enhanced by an amount which is called the dynamical critical exponent. This number should be 2 for an anti-ferromagnet, and interestingly enough, should be 3 for a ferromagnet. Now, from the theoretical point of view, this meant that everything was beautiful, because if d was equal to 3 and z was equal to 2, 3 plus 2 is 5, 5 is greater than the upper critical dimension for 5 to 4 field theory, so everything should be Gaussian. It should be that quantum critical behavior is under beautiful control. Okay? And moreover, alas, it should mean that the scaling properties, the hyperscaling properties we associate, for example, with the 3D Ising model, should be lost in quantum critical magnets. So, that's interesting, but it turns out to contradict experimental observations. Many of the experimental observations on these quantum critical anti-ferromagnets don't fit with this model. One prediction of this model, for example, for an anti-ferromagnet, is that gamma should be equal to a constant minus something proportional to the square root of t. And so this is a weak singularity which doesn't fit with the observations here. Okay. Another problem with this particular theory is that if you look at the Fermi surface for an anti-ferromagnet, these fluctuations carry momentum. They're staggered in space. And because they're staggered in space, it means that the only way an electron can absorb that momentum is if the wave vector of the initial and final state are separated by the characteristic q vector of the anti-ferromagnet. This is really q minus that q vector coming in there. Which means that typically you have hot lines around the Fermi surface where the electrons are very severely scattered. But in between, the Fermi sea should be tranquil and happy as on a summer's day. So the problem is that the linear resistivity and the sharp divergence in gamma suggests that this picture is wrong, that somehow the entire Fermi surface is becoming turbulent as you hit the quantum critical point. And that then poses a problem, because where is the momentum going to come from to scatter the electrons across the whole Fermi surface? Why is the effective mass of the electrons all over the Fermi surface being driven off to infinity? And the reaction of the theoretical community to this crisis bears a curious analogy with the reactions of the theoretical community 100 years ago when faced with the crisis of Diamond. So there are those who have sought to maintain the status quo. And so one of the questions you can ask is, well, what can we do to this that will save it from this difficulty? And one solution is to drop the dimension down from 3 to 2. Yeah? And it's hardly surprising, in the world of condensed matter physics, we live in an era of tremendous success of two dimensions. So it's only natural to want to believe that your three-dimensional crystal has some two-dimensional correlation inside it. And lo and behold, experiments suggest that there might be a quasi-two-dimensional aspect to the spin fluctuations in this material, cerium, copper, 6, gold. It turns out that the hot region in momentum space is not just a spot in momentum space, but it seems to extend like a kind of rod. And so it's tempting to say, well, maybe the spin fluctuations are quasi-two-dimensional. And if they're quasi-two-dimensional, it turns out that then you're at 2 plus 2 equals 4, you're at the marginal dimension, and you can explain the logarithmic specific heat with that simple explanation. And so initially there was some enthusiasm to the idea that the spin fluid might be quasi-two-dimensional. The only problem is that later some very fine neutron measurements on this material by one experimentalist, Almut Schroeder and collaborators, in about 99, revealed that the spin correlations, or the neutron scattering, which is at the critical Q vector a function of omega and T, revealed that this quantity, which is proportional to the neutron scattering cross-section as a function of energy E, actually can be scaled with a function which looks like a function of omega over T. And the data could be collapsed with an anomalous exponent here, which is about 0.75 or 0.8. And the appearance of this omega over T scaling is extremely mysterious from the point of view of this Lagrangian. And the reason is that omega over T scaling tells you that temperature, remember, what temperature does is it provides a cutoff for quantum mechanical processes. So temperature is like a cutoff in time or a cutoff in energy. And the fact is coming in the same power as omega is an example of naive scaling, which means it's rather similar to this way that, for example, when you take a critical classical system and put it in a box which is finite in one dimension, you get a correlation length that's proportional to that finite dimension. So in a similar way, kT, 1 over kT, plays the role of a length scale or a time scale in this quantum mechanical world. And so if you're dealing with fluctuations which have a characteristic time scale of 1 over kBT in a universe that's three-dimensional everywhere else, then, of course, if you're below your upper critical dimension, you would expect this 1 over kT to come in to produce this type of scaling. And this point was emphasized by one of our members, Catherine Pippa, some years ago. And so the appearance of this anomalous exponent suggests that the physics is below its upper critical dimension, which would mean for this theory you'd have to make D actually less than 2. And so the attempt to save the status quo has in some sense failed dismally for this particular material. And so what next? Well, there have been a number of proposals, and I'm not going to go through them in any detail at all. I'm just going to say a few of the words that have come with some of these proposals. And all of them are, to some extent or another, turning the standard paradigm on its head and trying to invent a new picture. So what options are available to you? Well, one idea that's had a lot of prominence has been the idea that perhaps the critical mode in the theory is not a long wavelength Goldstone mode, but some kind of mode that's sitting on the ions. And one of the things I haven't told you about in these systems is that you've got things called local moments, magnetic moments, that sit in the lattice. These magnetic moments are in some sense like the quark of condensed matter physics. And they're unconfined at high temperatures. They're unconfined in the magnet, but they become confined in the Fermi liquid. And so one of the ideas is that the fluctuating modes of that spin become critical in time, but not critical in space. And this idea of local quantum criticality was already suggested by the data of Schroeder. It turns out that this bizarre exponent is not only seen in the staggered susceptibility, but also in the uniform susceptibility, suggesting that something pervades all momentum space. And so this idea has been taken by Ingersen See and Smith, and they've developed a theory of local quantum criticality, in which they basically take a spin and expose it to a critical magnetic environment and solve the quantum physics of that spin in that critical quantum mechanical environment self-consistently. And they've been able to show that there are classes of solution for which the characteristic scale of the Fermi liquid collapses to zero at the same point as the Nail temperature. The only problem that I see in their solution is it once again requires a two-dimensional spin fluid, which, although is suggested by some aspects of the data in Serum Copper 6 Gold, surely does not pervade all of these three-dimensional systems. In fact, it's very hard to understand from a theoretical point of view why the spins would want to be quasi-two-dimensional in these systems. Even frustration does not provide a powerful enough influence to drive the characteristic spin fluctuations into a purely two-dimensional period. Yes, Matthew.
Why is two dimensions important? Sorry.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Turns out there's a criterion of self-consistency in this thing. It turns out that to drive this thing the way you want, you've got to have the local spin susceptibility diverge. Okay? Now, that local spin susceptibility is equal to the integral over the magnetic modes of the chi of Q. Okay? And the way you do it, these calculations, is that you introduce a coupling of the modes between sites, a magnetic coupling. And typically what happens is that you have a thing that involves Q squared plus something else in integrals here. And the only way to get this to diverge is to make D equal to 2. So it's that log divergence that drives the whole mechanism here. And without it, this reverts back over to the picture that Hertz came up with. Okay. So beyond this, we're approaching the precipice. And it's the precipice that's so very exciting. Because when you go over the precipice, you're in free fall, and all sorts of new ideas come to your mind. So I think that we're in a situation which is analogous to what Rayleigh referred to about this data here. And one of the questions I wanted to throw out, since this is an audience of diverse capabilities, is can we take inspiration from other sources? Is there the possibility that new ideas will come from looking at other areas of physics? And, of course, as you know, particle physics and cosmology have had, over different periods of their history, a close relationship with condensed matter physics. This went on from the period of discovering the Higgs mechanism and superconductivity. Classical criticality came from understanding of the normalization. So is there a possibility of new links today? And this is one area where there could be a link. If you look on the two sides of the divide, you see various unsolved problems which could influence one another. On the side of the particle physicists, we look avidly at the fact that you have new tools like string theory and supersymmetry, the demise of the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem. And on our side, of course, you look avidly at the fact we've got this profusion of data, huge amount of data, okay? And we've also got the loss of paradigms, the strange metals in the cuprates and at the quantum critical point. We don't fully understand the glass problem, despite years and years of effort. And so could there be links? We don't really know. I gather that the idea of energy landscapes is enjoying a renaissance in the realm of string theory at the moment. For our part, we don't have really a good mean field theory of these quantum critical points, and if the way forward is to expand around a good mean field theory, as Wilson and Fisher did, we need new ideas for that mean field theory. And one of the areas in which we've been working hard has been large N theories. Could there be new ways of solving large N theories that could come to us from perhaps string theory? Finally, it turns out that we need to look for a new kind of zero mode at this quantum critical point. And on this side of the diagram, the spins are behaving like bosons. And in fact, when we describe a magnet, we describe them as spin bosons using something called the Schwinger boson transformation or the Hallstein-Primakov approach. On this side, the spins are behaving like fermions, and they incorporate themselves, they develop a charge in a way that's very similar to a kind of Higgs phenomenon. And so at this point, they deconfine, and they seem to develop new kinds of zero modes that must be responsible for this log-specific heat and linear resistivity. Well, if those zero modes are bosons, then all we have to do is to make this damn thing much more complicated. But what new feature can we come up with? Well, one idea is to make it extremely non-local, but that's not going to help us. So could it be that at the point where the spin goes from being fermionic and confined to bosonic and free, could it be that there are fermionic modes at this critical point? Which would then mean that somehow the effective action at long distances would have to have fermions as an integral part to it. This then raises the specter of supersymmetry in some guise or other. And if you were here last Friday, you would have learned that certain supersymmetric models have emergent supersymmetry. Emergent supersymmetry meaning on the short distances, they're not supersymmetric, but that the flow diagrams suck you into a supersymmetric fixed point. Well, that suggests the possibility that there might just be new classes of field theory, both relativistic and non-relativistic perhaps, which govern new classes of quantum critical point, supersymmetry like zero temperature. And I think that's an interesting thought to think about here. Other than that, there's probably many other new ideas that can come about here. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you.
I mean, more, I just want to comment on some of the new ideas that involve gauge theories.
Yes.
And there's an obvious potential link with
right.
the other program. And yes. in particular, you know, gauge theories in the presence of Fermi C, sort of finite chemical potential in the language
Yes. Yes.
But also gauge theories where one has Dirac fermions, or relative fermions, and through a number of specific models, gauge theory models, in, for example, QED3, which in the condensed matter community, we really like to know the solution. You know, does it confine, does chiral symmetry break or not? And I don't know, I think in maybe we could learn some things, or take some things from the lattice gauge community.
Well, Matthew's question made me want to ask another question, which is that condensed matter physicists have discovered all these gauge theories and so on. How come they haven't discovered Einstein's theory, which is sort of a super fancy gauge theory?
Gravity.
Gravity.
I thought we have. I thought inside helium-3, at least according to Volovic, you have a whole world of gravity.
No, but with Einstein's, the mathematical structure of Einstein's theory,
Which of Einstein's theory?
So
I mean, general relativity. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose for that you need systems which have some kind of curvature, and systems like which have got exotic order parameters, such as liquid crystals and superfluids with exotic order parameters, are perhaps the domain in which those things might appear. Those, of course, have to be embedded in real space. We don't have the possibility.
It's an emerging anything, an emerging gauge theory.
That's right. Well, that's true. In fact, okay, now you've set me up, you see. If it turns out that large N can be used to solve this diagram here, then here and here vector large N models work very well, but we can't bring them together. So it might just be that this point here needs a tensor large N theory.
A matrix large N theory,
which would then mean that you'd be in the realm of emergent gravity. So it could just be that we've already discovered it, but we just don't know it. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, thank you.